I consider that the sunshine that Roger did in 2017 was, let's say, the most difficult one, because he beat Rafa twice, once in Indian Wells four round and then in Miami Open final. So I would say that particular year, Roger deserves all the credit.
What was so great about the Federer-Nadal matches, which their four matches at Indian Wells and Miami really highlighted, was that they were a contrast in styles. And for me, that's the best in tennis, when you have two different players. How does one guy's game match up against another?
I remember one year when they played one of the Wimbledon finals, and we were getting ready to broadcast a match at ESPN. And I said to our producer, I said, you know, this feels like the first three or five games, we shouldn't even say a word. Welcome, everyone, to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, proud to be the president of the Hall of Fame. Chris Bowers joining me. He and I have been working together for quite some time. Great to have you back as we continue our conversations this year, Chris, on Mr. Roger Federer, as he will be going into the Hall of Fame later this year. So welcome to you, firstly.
Grüezi, as they say in Switzerland.
That's it. Thank you so much. And Joan Solsana, who joins us straight from Spain, from Barcelona, as he is lead writer for many years for Marca, the newspaper, the biggest newspaper in Spain, and has covered all of tennis, but particularly Spanish tennis, for many, many years. Welcome to you, Joan. I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Thank you. Great to have both of you. Let me start with you, Chris, as we're nearing the end, as we're recording this, of the Miami tournament. Actually, I'm actually down in Miami as we speak, and I was out in Indian Wells a couple of weeks ago as well. And it's become termed the sunshine double, if you could actually win both of the tournaments, which has not happened that often. Chris, you know, even though when people watch these two tournaments on television, hard court, nice weather, looks pretty similar, actually the conditions are quite different, aren't they, at these two events?
Yes, they are. I mean, Federer won it three times, and I think it is a phenomenal achievement, especially if you've come off the Australian Open as well, which he did in 2017, which I think was the most remarkable sunshine double that he did. I'll come back to that later. But in terms of the two, yes, Indian Wells, the ball really does fly in the California desert. And there was always the feeling for many years is that you get slightly freakish results there. I'm not sure, actually, if that's still the case. People get used to the flight of the ball in Indian Wells. And Miami, which is no longer quite as coastal as it was, is perhaps a little bit more mainstream. In all the years that the Miami tournament was in Key Biscayne, which is an island very close to the center of Miami, but just off Miami, it was very vulnerable to some very heavy winds. It's not that it's free from the winds where it is now, but it's slightly more inland, and that I think does make a difference. But in a way, it's an odd season of the year, because for most of the Grand Slam tournaments, there's a build-up of tournaments on that surface, the clay courts in the run-up to Roland Garros, the grass courts in the run-up to Wimbledon, the North American hard courts in the run-up to the US Open. And here we have two massive tournaments which are separate from a slam, so it's almost like a season of its own.
Yeah, it's interesting. And both beautiful settings. The Miami tournament is now at the Hard Rock Stadium, which is a football stadium, American football stadium, for those of you that don't know. So it's kind of weird the way it's set up. It's sort of tucked away in a corner of the stadium. Similar, as you got, as I was coming on, you two were chatting about the stadium in Seville in Spain. And I want to bring this up because a gentleman who played in his first ever Davis Cup match, when I was the Davis Cup captain for the United States, we went to Spain. It was a championship match. Because there was so much attention, Spain decided to put it in the soccer stadium in Seville. It was much more suitable, I think, for viewing there, because it was kind of in the corner of the stadium. So you, I think they had about, Joan, maybe it was 25,000 people there in that stadium. And then this kid named Rafael Nadal all of a sudden joined the party. That was a little bit of a wake-up call for the American team, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the fact is that at that time we had Ferrero, that it was former top 10 player, and Tony Robredo was like 12 in the world, and Rafa was only 17 years old, and he was top 50. He had been losing like three matches in a row, so no one was expecting to see him playing the first day against Andy Roddick, number two player in the world. And we won that match, and Rafa, from that day, he became a star, yeah.
Yeah, but you got that right. And we were thinking, and as I was the captain of the American team, when they announced the selection and he was going to play Nadal on the first day, Andy Roddick, who was our top player. And, you know, obviously clay wasn't his best surface, but he was a great competitor and we knew he was going to battle hard. We thought, oh, maybe we got a shot. They're putting this 17-year-old in. And in fact, I'll tell you a quick story because I know we want to get back to the Sunshine Double and Federer. But Roddick, it was a set all in the match, and it was the third set went to a tiebreak. So it was still very close, but Roddick was starting to tire. The conditions were quite heavy. It was getting to be at night. And Roddick was serving, I believe it was like 5-6 in the tiebreak. And Joanne, he looked over to me, which he never did. And he asked me where he should serve on the first serve. It was such a pressure moment. So I just said immediately, middle, you know, go T, because that was his best serve. He missed a serve. I think it was actually set point for him. He missed a serve by this much. And then, of course, had to hit a second serve. And, you know, Rafa did his forehand. And then by the fourth set, Roddick was done. But we still thought we had a chance. So blame it on me. I made the wrong call on the serve, where to serve it.
Yeah, but I need to tell you a secret that I'm going to tell you now, 22 years later, that Nadal at the third set and the fourth set, he was cramping in the arms and in the hands. Because, of course, for a kid, was a lot of pressure to play the number two player in the world. And at the end of the day, he doesn't know how he won that match.
Amazing. Well, he won it. He won it going away in the fourth set. But let's talk about that rivalry specifically in Miami and in Indian Wells too. But it really started in Miami, didn't it, Krista? He was a teenager and he upset Roger Federer at the Miami tournament there early on. Tell us your memories of that one.
Well, I was just going to say, actually, that when you would have been researching this kid playing in the Davis Cup final in 2004, you would have said, well, hang on, a few months ago, he beat Roger Federer in Miami, because that was the first time that he came to the world's attention. He came to my attention a year earlier because we just had Richard Gasquet, who at the age of 16 won a match at the Monte Carlo Masters, and everybody got very excited. He beat Franco Squillari. And then I remember someone saying to me, yeah, don't get too excited about Gasquet. The Spaniards have this youngster about the same age. And a few weeks later, he played Carlos Moya in Hamburg, and he beat Moya. And it was he was so confident about it. And therefore, when he beat Federer, I wasn't entirely surprised, especially as it turned out later, he was slightly under the weather that day. It was third round. But at the end of the day, Nadal beat him. What we didn't realize, I think, until a year later, their second match, also in Miami, was just how much Nadal had worked out how to play Federer. And it took Federer, well, he survived on his own experience for a few years. And then when Nadal really got into the peak of his career, it took Roger a long time before he worked out how to play Rafa.
And it's interesting too, Joanne, the conditions in Indian Wells, when the two of them especially met, obviously Roger had great success in Indian Wells. And as Chris mentioned later in his career too, but because of the bounce of the ball, that high, heavy bounce, and Rafa was able to employ that, use that topspin and get the ball up, you know, consistently over the shoulder. Was that when, you know, you knew him when he was quite young and early on in the rivalry. Was that part of when it sort of clicked for Rafa? Like, I could just go to the well and play this way and beat this guy pretty consistently.
Yeah, and it's also one of the reasons why Rafa won in Indian Wells several times and he never won in Miami, because the conditions in Indian Wells suits him much better in the way and the style he plays. And when he was facing Roger and he was putting a lot of balls in Roger's backhand, of course it helps. That's why I consider that the sunshine that Roger did in 2017 was, let's say, the most difficult one, because he beat Rafa twice, once in Indian Wells four round and then in Miami Open final. So I would say that particular year, Roger deserves all the credit, yeah.
Yeah, and that was when he sort of came back from that knee injury, remember, and Federer had, and he worked on that backhand. He switched to rackets as well, which I think played a part. But the stubbornness of Federer, Chris, for years, to not change anything, because, you know, he was such a maestro, right? He was so good. And later in his career, not just Nadal, but also Novak Djokovic, you know, started to catch him. And then at subsequently overtake him with total majors. But what was it about him? Let's go back to those prime years, though, because in for the title 04 and then 05, 06, when he really was dominating the tour, I think he averaged those 3 years, I think he averaged 4 or 5 losses a year for the entire year, for like a 3-year window. And this was part of that sunshine double window, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And he was just so good. I mean, it's a big debate about how many Grand Slams would Federer have won if Nadal and Djokovic had come in earlier. But then if they hadn't been there, how many would he have won? I suspect the answer is anything between 12 and 30. He ended up with 20. So it's a pretty good haul, especially given the competition he was up against. I think, though, that you mentioned recovering from the knee injury in 2016. I think the person we need to give an awful lot of credit to here is Ivan Ljubicic. Federer was not easy to coach. He needed people to be good dinner partners the night before matches. But in terms of coaching, really, he could do it all. There wasn't much you could teach Roger. But he did have this one weakness against the high bouncing ball to his backhand. And in that time that he was recovering from the knee injury, in the second half of 2016, Ljubicic said to him, "There is no reason why you cannot beat Nadal with the ball bouncing high to your backhand." And he didn't prepare for the Australian Open final of 2017. But it all came good then in that glorious 20 minutes from 3-1 down to 6-3 final set for Federer, because that was when Nadal was really kicking the ball to Federer's high backhand and Federer was dealing with it. And having won that match, that was where he played some of his best tennis at Indian Wells and Miami when he did the Sunshine Double in 2017. When he beat Nadal it was the middle of the tournament in 2017 in Indian Wells, he dropped just 5 games. And then he beat him 2 weeks later in Miami. He dropped 7 games. And that was some of the best tennis he ever played against Nadal. And it was because the fear of the high ball to the backhand had gone. And you're absolutely right, Patrick. Roger is stubborn. All great champions are stubborn. But the fact is, it took him until that stage in his career really to master the one weakness. And I think one of the reasons why he didn't master it till then is that he got away with that fantastic slice, which just knifed through the court. So he never really had to worry about it. But against Nadal, on any surface, but particularly on clay, you had to have a decent reply to the high bouncing ball to the backhand. And he finally developed it.
A real treat here for me at Patrick McEnroe on the Tennis Worthy podcast. And we have two of the great minds, two of the great journalists, historians of tennis in the last 40, 50 years, Chris Bowers and Joan Solsana joining me here. Joan, I remember I was going through the matches that Roger played in these two tournaments, Indian Wells, Miami, and I broadcasted a lot of them because we at ESPN used to cover these tournaments for the last 4 or 5 days, which we don't anymore. But I remember one of those, the final in Indian Wells, and Federer beat Leighton Hewitt. And Hewitt was at the top of his game. And early on in Federer's career, Hewitt was someone that gave him trouble because Roger wasn't quite sure. It was almost like when he first started playing Hewitt, he tried to come in all the time. He tried to play aggressive. And then something clicked with Federer when he realized, actually, I can just play sort of defensively against Hewitt. I can use my slice. I can maneuver the ball. What do you think that was just something that happened in his mind, or was it partly he got fitter, he got stronger, more experienced when he realized I'm an all-court player. I can pretty much beat this guy by playing neutral, more neutral tennis and wait for my opportunity instead of forcing it?
Yeah, and I also have to say regarding what Chris said, that apart from Ljubicic, what also helped Roger in the style of game against Nadal, for instance, was Stefan Edberg after. Because the fear that Chris said about the backhand with Stefan Edberg disappeared completely. And in the matches against Hewitt, I would say that Hewitt's style of game, let's say, was close to the Spanish style of game players. So Roger knew that if he wanted to beat, let's say, Nadal, it was a good test also to beat a guy like Hewitt, that his style of game was from the baseline to put a lot of balls in, long rallies. So it's for sure that if you check the Roger style of tennis from the beginning of his career, let's say 2002, when he played the first ATP finals in Shanghai, and you see Roger in the last 3-4 years of his career, there's a development in the style. Of course, he was not afraid of playing from the baseline, even he was older, but he had for sure more weapons than at the beginning of his career.
Yeah, and Leighton Hewitt was a guy, unlike Nadal, that couldn't put the heavy topspin on the ball. So once Federer sort of figured him out, and he figured out, got, you know, David Ferrer was another guy who had a similar style to Hewitt, but didn't generate that serious topspin. And Federer would just have a field day with those players. I mean, those guys, he would just toy with those guys once he got into that groove, because he could pretty much beat you any way he wanted, Chris. And even, you know, Tim Henman is a guy, another guy who played in Federer late in a couple of those Sunshine Double tournaments. And so was another guy, a Hall of Famer by the name of Andre Agassi. And those were some interesting matchups when he played against Andre, particularly down here in Miami.
Yeah, if you look at Federer's early career, he struggled to beat a number of players. You mentioned Henman there. For me, one of the ones was Nalbandian. He really struggled to beat Nalbandian. Hewitt took a long time. I mean, against Hewitt, there were the two matches at the Rod Laver Arena, Davis Cup semi-final in September 03, and then the fourth round on Australia Day in 2004 at the Australian Open. The first one, Hewitt won. He was 2 points from losing. Hewitt in the third set, won it in five, and was just freakishly good that day, Hewitt. He was so quick around the court. So was Federer, but because Hewitt was so quick, we didn't quite appreciate just how quick Federer was. And then once Federer had beaten him, he had his number. And it was the same with Henman. Once he'd beaten Henman, he knew how to play him. Nalbandian the same, although Nalbandian had that amazing win, only the fourth defeat of 2005 for Federer in the ATP Finals final, Tennis Masters Cup, as it was called then, in Shanghai. And I just think Federer, because he had so many options, they often say this about players who have lots of options, it takes longer to mature because they have to work out what shot to play when. They have to learn their decision-making. And therefore, there was a number of players, Agassi was among them, who Federer had to work out. But once he'd worked them out, it was almost like there was no way back. The one player that didn't work with was Nadal, possibly also Djokovic.
Yeah, and when you look at the head-to-head, Joanne, of Federer and Nadal, and you, the one match we haven't mentioned in Miami was the final in 2005, when Roger came from two sets down against Rafa, brutally hot conditions, ball, you know, staying in the pocket a little bit better for Roger, but he had to win the third set in a tiebreak, and then won the last two sets pretty easily. Was that a turning point, sort of physically, mentally, for Roger in the head-to-head, or just overall, where people saw, you know, obviously we knew about his talent and his greatness, but also his toughness?
Yeah, you know, if you remember that final, there was some close balls that I would say that nowadays with the Hawkeye, maybe the result of the final should be different.
And what about what it just said about Federer, Chris, that he could dig deep?
He could, but, you know, I think that was more a writing on the wall match, because he'd lost the previous year, but okay, he didn't really know Nadal. He'd been slightly ambushed by him and he was slightly under the weather. This time it was a best of five final. And really, Federer only won that because Nadal tired. I mean, Nadal won the first set 6-2. He won the second set after Federer had been 5-2 up. And that was, I think, signs of Federer, despite having a lead against Nadal, it was never safe until he'd actually wrapped it up. Then in the third set, Nadal led 4-1, got tired. Federer won it on a tiebreak, 7-5, and after that lost only four games. Now, Federer could put that one down to just greater experience and greater strength. But a few weeks later, Nadal went to Roland Garros, having not lost a match since that Miami final, and beat Federer in the semi-finals. Okay, the match finished in near darkness, but nonetheless, Nadal beat him and won the tournament. The next two finals at Roland Garros, he beat Federer. Federer beat Nadal in the next two finals at Wimbledon, 06 and 07. But what was interesting, at the end of the 07 final, Federer said, "Oh, I've got to be careful to win these matches before Nadal gets too good." Well, he won that 07 final at Wimbledon in five sets. And that was his last win over Nadal at a Grand Slam tournament for 9.5 years until that amazing 2017 final. So I think when we look back at that Miami final of 2005, it was Federer winning it on the basis of greater strength and greater experience. But it was a real warning that once this young kid from Spain can get his act together, Federer won't be able to hold with him. And that was pretty much the truth until Federer beat Nadal in the Basel final of 2015, which started a run of 5 wins, including those 2 Sunshine double wins in 2017.
Yeah, we know about, we all of us have followed some of the great rivalries in tennis. My brother and Borg, Martina, Chrissy, Sampras, Agassi. Maybe we have one now, Alcaraz, Sinner. We'll see how that shapes up. Sabalenka, Rybakina, we should give them a pop because they both have been kind of dominating women's tennis. But certainly, Joanne, there was something unique, wasn't there, about Roger, Rafa. I mean, obviously Novak came and did what he did and had epic matches with both of them, particularly Rafa in Australia and so on. But it was something about the two of them. I remember one year when they played one of the Wimbledon finals, and we were getting ready to broadcast a match at ESPN. And I said to our producer, I said, you know, this feels like the first 3 or 5 games, we shouldn't even say a word. And we sort of did that because it was, when they two went out there, there was a different buzz about it in the stadium, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, when you play against each other 40 times, of course, it's special. It's true that later Djokovic came, and with Rafa, they play even more times. But for Rafa memories, the Wimbledon finals, as you said, it was the most special ones. The reason why is because it's the only surface that where he thought from the beginning that Federer was better. That's why if Rafa needs to pick a final to win, was the final 2008, because Roger was in front of, because the darkness, because the rain, because the pain in the foot. There were so many elements that for sure he's going to choose always Wimbledon final 2008, like the greatest one for him.
You talked earlier, Chris, about where these tournaments fit sort of in the global tennis schedule, Miami and Indian Wells. And of course, I've been out there at the site talking to some people who are sort of casual tennis fans, and they said, well, where does tennis go next? I said, well, now next they go to Monte Carlo and start, you know, to get ready for that, for the, as you said, the clay court season leading into Roland Garros. How difficult a transition is that for these players? I mean, obviously someone like Rafa was looking forward to it. Federer, you know, was a great clay court player despite winning just one title in Paris because of Rafa mostly. But what about that transition for the players and sort of the nature of switching surfaces pretty quickly now?
I think it was bigger at the start of Federer's career than it is now. I mean, these days, they tend to play their own game, regardless of the surface. You see them sliding on a hard court, which I'm old enough that it still gives me the shivers when I see a player doing that. I think, what's it going to do to their ankles? But they play with the slide on a hard court the way they slide on clay. The way Sharapova mastered clay, despite being all at sea in the early part of her career. I think the transition in the early days was big. And I think maybe actually Federer needed to work on the transition more. I mean, he was no mug on clay. He learnt to play on clay. I mean, in Switzerland, most of the club courts have clay courts, and the good ones will have an indoor court in winter, which is generally a fast carpet. So that's where, you know, the likes of Federer and also, you know, Becker and Edberg, they did the clay in the summer and the fast indoor courts in winter, and you find out your strengths. What I found interesting was that the last time Federer and Nadal played each other in a Grand Slam was the semifinals of Wimbledon in 2019. And that was almost like an equalization of their styles. What was so great about the Federer-Nadal matches, which their 4 matches, Indian Wells and Miami, really highlighted, was that there were a contrast in styles. And for me, that's the best in tennis, when you have two different players. How does one guy's game match up against another? By the time they played in 2019 at Wimbledon, they were almost playing the same game. You could recognize that the way they played their strokes, it wasn't like you'd mix up one from the other. But the game was far, far closer. And I think that's the story of Federer's and Nadal Nadal's careers, that at the beginning, you'd say Nadal was a clay courter who adapted his game for grass and hard, and Federer was a fast court player who developed his game for clay. By the end, they were all court players.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's interesting, Joanne, too, when you look at the way the game has evolved, right? Where you've got, you know, an Alcaraz now who can play on anything, who can do it all. Sinner, who sort of elevated the Djokovic style to another level. But, you know, Roger and Rafa sort of changed things, didn't they? Because, I mean, Djokovic is, to me, technically the greatest player ever, right? In addition to his record, you know, just his shots. But Roger with his flair and, you know, played a slice short. And obviously Rafa with the topspin off the forehand, his relentless, you know, movement. But nobody still to this day has hit the ball with as much topspin consistently as Rafa did off the forehand. So how about the way both these players sort of changed the game and pushed the evolution of the game forward?
For sure, the big three, they push each other as much as Alcaraz and Sinner, they push each other nowadays. And it's for sure that if Federer and Nadal didn't change his game and didn't develop his game at the middle of his career, Djokovic, instead of 24 Grand Slams, maybe he would have 30. Because the reality is that because Djokovic stepped down, the other guys, they need to push. Otherwise, Djokovic would have won much more slams than Roger and Nadal, 100%.
Why do you think, Joanne, that we know the popularity of all these players, but there seems to be something unique about Federer? I mean, our tickets for the Hall of Fame weekend sold out in about 2 minutes because of that one name, Roger Federer. What about what he's done off the court, and why is he so popular?
You know, I will put you several examples. For instance, in December, I was in Stuttgart for the signature of WTA and Mercedes as global ambassadors. And Roger was there as Mercedes ambassador. All the focus was on Roger, not about the WTA agreement with Mercedes. I mean, and Roger just fly from Dubai to stay there, and that's it. But he was the main focus. In the Australian Open, the day before the tournament starts, the focus was that Roger was going to play an exhibition with Agassi, Hewitt, and Patrick Rafter. And 1 month later, I met Roger in Dubai, because he lives there. And the focus, the first day of the tournament, is that he went there to see his friend Stan Wawrinka playing the first match. These are the clear examples why Roger is unique and his image is so much global, no matter if he's playing or not. And I don't think that he's going to happen with Nadal or when Djokovic is retiring. I mean, his image is not going to be like at the top level as much as Roger is still at the top.
I think also, Patrick, that one of the things that makes Federer different from, say, Nadal and Djokovic is that you see the full range of his shots. And I think that's almost slightly unfair to Nadal and Djokovic. I mean, you talked about Nadal playing his Davis Cup debut against your American team in the 2004 final. Actually, it wasn't his Davis Cup debut. It was his singles debut. But he had played doubles that year. And he's a remarkable doubles player. And if you see Nadal's net game, it is incredibly good. And we only saw it in singles, I think, in that 2020 final with a very small crowd at Roland Garros, where he was unbelievable at the net against Djokovic. I think that was probably his greatest single match. Djokovic has tremendous talent. This is going to sound horrible. I'd love to have seen Djokovic have a slight wrist injury to his left wrist, because I think we would have seen just how good Djokovic is in other aspects of the game that we don't normally see. The thing about Federer used all his weapons, especially if he was, say, 6-2, 4-2 up in a tour match, when he'd just say, right, OK, I'm sort of home now. Let's just have a bit of fun. And he would play some drop shot that no one would try outside the last 5 minutes of a practice court. And there was a half-volley forehand he hit in his semi-final against Roddick at Wimbledon in 2003. And I remember watching it thinking, you can't hit that forehand from there. You're in the wrong part of the court. It's not going to happen. And he flicked the wrist and he hit it into the corner. And in a way, because he allowed himself to play those shots that most players only play in the last 5 minutes of a practice session, we got to see the full range of Federer in a way that you don't see on other players. You perhaps see the full range when players get injured because they suddenly have to rely on other skills that they don't normally show. But Federer, you saw it all the time.
Yeah, now we're seeing Carlos Alcaraz push the envelope and play shots that we didn't think were possible. But before I let you both of you guys go, and I certainly appreciate your time, we could and we will go on pretty much all day for the rest of the year on different Federer topics. So we'll get to both of you guys later in the year as well. But to wrap it up, let me start with you, Chris. Kind of ask you what I just asked Joanne, because you've seen so many all-time greats. You know, I don't want to date you, but you've been around a while. You've seen, you know, Martina and Serena and Bjorn and my brother and, you know, Becker and all, you know, what is it about Roger that transcends tennis and really sports in a lot of ways? What is it about him, the person?
I think there is something indefinable. It's not a way of dodging the question. I remember when I was broadcasting, if we had Federer on, we would be primed for a very special event because the viewing or listening figures would go through the roof. They'd be high for Nadal and Djokovic, but they wouldn't be as high. There was something magical about Federer. And what's interesting was that once he got his temper under control, people don't realize that he had a fiery temper as a child. Once he got that under control, he was quite dour in terms of the way he looked on a tennis court. And yet, because he had the wonderful stroke making, I think people saw through that. He was also an absolutely wonderful individual. He took the view, not that everybody was good, but that everybody had something to teach him. So whenever he went on some sponsor trips or some promotional things, which perhaps most players would say, oh, goodness, do I have to really do this? Oh, all right, OK, I'll do it. I'll put on the smile. He actually said, no, if this is what I have to do, there'll be something in it for me. There'll be something that I can learn from it. He had that most wonderful attitude where everybody he met had something to teach him. Everything he did was something that he could learn from. And I think the attitude that he had was something that people, at a level they probably never quite realized, just warmed to. And that is a big part of why he had the magnetism, which in many respects is so indefinable.
Yeah, so it's the time for Carlos Alcaraz, Joanne. You were able to witness an all-timer in Rafael Nadal in your country. Now you've got Alcaraz, who it seems to me has learned some of those things Chris was just talking about from Federer, how to put on a show in addition to being an all-time player.
Yeah, I mean, of course, in terms of style, let's say that Carlos is more equal, more similar to Roger, that he can do anything with the racket. Of course, his idol was Nadal.
He has to say that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But maybe behind the scenes is not that clear. And for sure, for the game, when Roger finished his career, everybody was wondering, oh, the tennis will miss Roger so much. And for sure we do. But at the same time, we have someone like Carlos that is giving a show quite similar to Roger.
Well, you guys put on a show here today. Two of the great tennis minds, Joanne Solsana, Chris Bowers. Thank you so much for joining me, Patrick McEnroe, on the Tennis Worthy podcast.
Thanks.
You're welcome.